Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. I'm delighted to be joined live on the line by James Henry, British comedy screenwriter who's worked on Green Wing Campus and Delivery Man. He's also got a book out called Pagans, which we shall touch on as well. But he joins me live and direct at this moment. James, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Hello.
And whereabouts are you for our listeners so they know exactly where you are, where we're talking from?
I'm currently in a hotel opposite the Savoy, but not the actual Savoy.
You should have said I'm a stone's throw from the Savoy. Are you on a book tour then at the moment, or are you just slumming it?
I'm signing a lot of books. I'm just wandering around central London today, signing lots of books, a handful.
Presumably your own books and not sort of other people's books. I mean, that's.
Well, I might get carried away and just start signing the nearest books after a while, but we'll see how it goes.
Let's talk about the 300-pound elephant in woad in the room, which is the book Pagans. See what I did there. Just explain, because I know that you've spoken with Hannah about this, and that will be in a later interview. But the book Pagans takes a bit of a strange look. It's a what if, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an alternate. I've always liked alternate history books where, you know, what if things went slightly different and everything changed? So it's a little bit, it's kind of one of those things. It's sort of a parallel present. It's a Britain in which we're still divided between Celts and Saxons and the Norse to the north in Scotland. But everyone's got this social media, there's police cars, there's murders, and it's really a crime story. It's two detectives who have to team up to take down a serial killer, really. That's what it is.
I'm just wondering what a Norse social media feed would look like. An awful lot of runic, I would imagine.
A lot of runes.
Yeah.
Yeah, an awful lot of runes, a lot of kenning, a lot of flighting.
Pimp my longboat, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it'd be quite weird. I mean, it's in this world, Britain is divided into three separate nations. So there's the tribal West, which is the Celts, where all the Celts have been pushed into the southwest and Wales. There's Saxon England, and there's the Independent Republic of Scotland to the north, with the Hadrian's Wall is kind of a Berlin Wall to keep out the sort of Saxon car bombers, that kind of thing.
So, right. Yeah.
So on the surface, it looks like Britain, and it is Britain, and then everyone has different beliefs. So paganism is a state religion. There's no Christianity. People do believe in hundreds of gods and all that sort of thing. So it's very familiar and very weird at the same time.
Now, you people will know you from the screenwriting. So how sort of different? What sparked your curiosity in pagans, and how different a discipline is it between writing for the screen and writing novels or historical work, for example? Do you approach them in two different ways?
Kind of. I mean, where it came from, where pagans came from originally, I'm from Cornwall. I grew up in Cornwall. Then I spent a lot of time in Canterbury and Kent. And they're just culturally weirdly different, even though people don't look that different. They're very, very different. And there was something really interesting in the idea of an East-West kind of cultural divide. There's supposed to be there is a north-south divide. If you're from Cornwall, you're not part of that at all. It has nothing to do with you. So an east-west divide is more kind of interesting. And that was something I've been wanting to play around with for a long time. And did it come from the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes coming into the east of Britain and kind of pushing all the Celts southwest? So they have very different kind of mindsets. But yeah, basically how it came about is I'm part of a comedy writing team. So we worked on ever since Smack the Pony, really, in Green Wing and Campus and Piglets. And we handed in a couple of sort of new projects just before lockdown, essentially. And then lockdown happened. And then there was, will they in fact be television in the future? We don't know. And I thought, well, this is kind of if I'm not going to write a book now, I'm probably never going to write it. So I was really kind of looking after the kids while my wife held down a job and paid the mortgage because my you know, work had just stopped. So I just kind of wrote 500 words every morning and just sort of cracked on with it until I had a book. So that's how it came about, I guess.
And I mean, did you always want to be involved? Because do people sort of fall into writing? Did you sort of fall into television, or was there an actual sort of a stepping stone progression? So, you know, as a small child, you know, you had the big finger come down from the heavens of whatever Norse god it particularly was at that point and said, you will be a writer for television.
Yeah, well, no, I wanted to be a writer. I didn't consider television until I was at university, and there was a course where you got to try all sorts of different things. And one of the things you got to try was the television format. The way a script is laid out is one page of script equals roughly 1 minute of television. And it's not that complicated. You can learn how the format works in about 20 minutes or something. And something in my brain really clicked with it. I was like, oh, I like this. There's something, you know, you don't have much to work with, but you can get a lot done. It was really interesting. So that kind of clicked. And then later I essentially won a, it's very uncool. I won a competition essentially with Channel 4, a sitcom writing competition. One of the judges was Victoria Pyle, who was putting together Smack the Pony. And one of the other judges was a guy called Dick Handsome, who was an animation producer. He was doing Bob the Builder. So I was working in a bookshop and I started writing scripts and sketches and sort of little scripts for the kids' TV and that sort of stuff at the same time. So it was a kind of a gradual process, really. I sort of fell into it.
And when you see this is going to show my age, okay? But you see, when I think of a script writer, my mind goes back to one of my favourite pictures of all time, and this will show what a anorak I am. But it's Dennis Norden and it's Frank Muir, and they've got a writer's desk, and they're opposite each other. And they used to write the comedy sketches with like a two-man desk, which is a bleeding marvellous creation. When you're writing for a comedy, you know, on a TV show, do you all sort of rock up and go, well, here's what I've been working on, and then, you know, your colleagues tear it apart, and then you have to throw your ego out the window and go, but that's my favourite bit, sirrah. Does the process take a week? And obviously, as writers, because I've been known to scribble a bit, you know, as Douglas Adams said, I love deadlines, I love the whooshing sound they make as they fly overhead.
Oh, yes, I very much relate to that, yeah. No, I mean, writing for television, the way we kind of made up our own way of doing it. So we'd kind of come together for a few days and compare notes, and we'd sit around and write silly things and put them in a tray, essentially, and read what everyone's done at the end of the day. And then we go away and write our own stuff for kind of weeks on end, then we sort of come back again. So it's a little bit of a hybrid of the American way of doing it, but they have an awful lot more money and our slightly weird British sociopathic kind of way of doing it. So it's a bit of the best of, you know, in a way, the best of both worlds, apart from the money.
it's not money.
But the sort of fun aspect is definitely there. Yeah, so it's all very collaborative, and you're kind of trying to outdo each other sometimes with the jokes and who can do the best funny bit about this particular idea, and that's really great. I enjoy that.
And when you're writing for a series, for example, for I don't know, for an 8-episode or something like that, a comedy. I mean, are you writing? Is it in one big hit, or are you writing as the week goes by? And if so, does the public opinion, if you're getting feedback on what you've written already, presumably that must put an awful lot of stress on you? Because if it's not hitting the mark, then you think, oh, blimey, yeah, I'd be funny. And if it is hitting the mark, it's the difficult second album syndrome. I.e., how am I going to reproduce that one?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it's all written long before it goes out. So that's, you know, that's not a problem. Yeah, I mean, it's weird with reviews. You can just immerse yourself in reviews and live or die by the next sort of Twitter comment. But after a while, you just go, I forget it. And you just sort of tune it out. Or you tune back in every now and then and go, well, you know, some people hate it, some people like it, it's fine. You can't live or die by that.
But surely if you've had work out there in the public domain, I've always laughed because, you know, if you've been an actor, a painter, a writer before social media, and you've got panned by people, then in this modern age of social media, it's water off the proverbial's back, because we've already had that, because we've been writing in the public domain before people started getting clobbered on whatever social media they happen to sort of indulge themselves in.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I've got friends who write, you know, proper historical dramas, and people get very angry with them because the buttons are in the wrong place, and, you know, things like that. But I'm like, well, you know, try writing comedy, because they hate you. If they don't like it, they really hate you. And I'm the same. If I watch something that's comedy, and it's not to my taste, I get quite cross. If I watch a drama and it's not my cup of tea, I'll just turn over or watch something else. I'm not that bothered. But people have such a personal reaction with comedy, which is really interesting, and I have it as well, so I'm not judging. But yeah, there's something about a comedy, you sitting down to watch comedy and you don't like it, and it just strikes to your heart, and these people must hate you. You know, it's a weirdly personal relationship. On the other hand, if people like it, they really, really like it. So it's, you know, it swings around about.
Here's a curveball for you, James, and I'm very sorry, but you look like you're sitting comfortably, so here we go. Actors.
Yes. A necessary evil, obviously.
Because I'm just thinking, have you ever sat down and you've written, have you written with a particular actor in mind? Does the director change it? Do you think I'd like it, this one to be, you know, sort of quasi Ray Winston? I mean, how do you write for an actor? Do you have one in mind? And have you ever written, you don't have to name names, have you ever written a part and then gone, you know, I kind of see what the director's going to go do that, but, you know, I wanted it to be Audrey Hepburn and you've given me the Vivian.
Well, no, it's if I'm writing something on spec, like something that no one's asked for, I just want to write a film script or something like that, I find it very useful to get an actor's voice in my head. So it's not so much the look, just the rhythm of the way they speak. So I might start writing something and going, oh, hang on, this is Simon Pegg in Shaun of the Dead. This is very much his little voice patterns and rhythms and that. So the rhythm is really, really important. By the time I finish writing it, it's that character's probably become their own person. And I kind of lose interest once the script's done anyway. I'm not a producer or a director. Once the script's done, I just want someone else to go and deal with it. And I've been very lucky because with Green Wing and the other things I've written, the stuff has come out pretty much as I heard. I didn't tend to see things visually, but I could hear them. And the rhythm has always been bang on. I mean, the way we did Green Wing is we'd write a scene, then we'd go down into the basement of Talkback, who produced it, and it'd be like Mark Heap and Steve Mangan and Tamsin Gregg and people, and to varying degrees, they'd read it out, and some of them would improvise and muck about and take things out and things. I think it's great. And you go back and you write that back in to your script. And if you're someone like Mark Heap as well, who's so funny, you quite often just take out entire lines because I don't need this line. I've just got Mark Heap raising an eyebrow, and that's really funny. He says everything you need to say. We don't need my dialogue cluttering it up. It's absolutely fine. So it's very, very collaborative, and you can't be precious with comedy, I don't think. And then when they go out to film, because digital video is cheap, they'll do the same thing. They'll do the scene as written, and then they'll muck about and kind of have another go at it. And that was very specifically how we did it with Green Wing. We haven't quite done that the other way. And it's Stephen Mangan and Mark Heap and people. You just want to feed them stuff and then watch them go mad and have a fantastic time. It's great.
I mean, this must be one of the things as well I remember the people say, what sort of actor do you want to be? And the people say, I want to be Shakespearean. And I say, I want to be a working one, simple as that. And when it comes to writing, you just want to be a working writer. So, I used to edit magazines, and I had some journalists who go, my God, you cut my third paragraph off, and how could you do this to me? And it's like, well, you had to do this to fit the bleeding thing because you were going on about the same thing. How important is it not to be precious about your stuff?
You can't be precious at all about it. I mean, you've got to have some integrity. This is why I think I write stuff to make myself laugh or to write what I'm interested in. And then you care about it. And if you're standing up for something, you really are. If you're writing something that you don't care about, you don't care. It doesn't matter. People cut bits off it. You go, I'm not really that bothered. If it's comedy that I care about, I will fight for a particular line and go, look, it needs to be there because it doesn't quite work without it. But it's, again, comedy is very collaborative. You have to, what's that? You have to kill your darlings. You have to let things go. And also, this time is so tight. Like this ITV thing we're writing for is 22 and a half minutes per episode. And it's not ensemble show. No one's going to get enough lines that they're happy. You've got so little, which is what I like. I like the challenge, but you've got so little time to get stories across and make people laugh as well. It's a really fun technical challenge, at the risk of sounding a bit dry.
Yeah. I'm one of the people that I've interviewed several times because he's quite easy to get. It's a guy called Damien Lewis, and he's a military historian. He's written all these SAS books. And he's got this fun, he writes in a chapel, and his writing room is the pulpit, which I think is, I mean, he's got my life, basically.
Good Lord.
I know, okay. Indeed. And he churns these books out, but he likes being a writer because he outside bad, inside good, because that's the writer's thing. And then he went and then he wrote The Ministry for Ungentlemanly Warfare, which was picked up by bleeding Guy Ritchie. Producer.
Guy Ritchie, I love that film.
Exactly, and it was a massive success. And he had to go to New York and do the red carpet. And he said, I have never been so uncomfortable in my life, as they're all standing around being lovies. And they're he's a writer, so he'd like ourselves. I'm not wearing my glasses now, but he's got his glasses on. He's slightly disheveled, like we often are. James, how do you handle the public adoration and all those red carpets?
If I ever have public adoration or red carpets, I'll let you know. I was with Steve Mangan. We went for a drink after something, which is on Brick Lane. We'd gone up one set of steps to go into a bar, and the whole street outside was packed. And it turns out there was a rumour that Radiohead were playing a secret gig. And everyone just happened to look up and see Steve Mangan, who is, he's quite well known at the time. And suddenly there were like 4,000 people going, oh, look, a famous. There's a famous. And I was standing next to him and just having that many people turn around looking at someone next to me, not at me. I was just like, oh, I don't like this. That was the most I'm not cut out for this. I don't mind I do lectures occasionally. I don't mind being on stage and kind of talking and stuff like that. But that was too much. He was like soaking it up in the best possible way. He was just, that's his world.
I was once on a roof, back in the day, I was on a rooftop disco at this disco nightclub, and somehow I ended up sitting on the seat next to, or the sofa next to Jamiroquai, JK, that lot, yeah? And because he'd had cancelled a gig, and I had two friends of mine who are Italian models, so I look like the manager, and they look beautiful, and JK's with beautiful people. And that night, you know when the Americans go to bomb something, they miss, as they call it, and they hit a bus of nuns or something, you know, or whatever, yeah. And they call it collateral damage.
Yeah.
Well, that night I got collateral bimbos because I got girls who thought I was with JK and must be with him, who were throwing themselves and with all these Italians, and they thought that I, so that was, you know, like they thought that I was part. So I got collateral from that. So that was what you got that day.
Yeah, everyone wins. That's fantastic. They get to enjoy your company.
Yes, indeed.
It's all fine.
And we get to put the social media. Book tours. You're in the middle of one at the moment. You're signing books. What's that like?
It's quite odd. I used to work in the bookshop, and I used to work in Canterbury, and I used to run events. I used to do Q&As with authors. So you get quite big names coming down from London, which is great. It was really exciting. So it's quite, I'm not so much meeting the public. I'm sitting and signing a stack of books in one shop and then running to the next one. I'm going to be signing a stack of books there. But it's so lovely to be back in book world. I know that world so well. I know bookselling world and I know booksellers, and they're a special breed.
And we should, of course, support our own independent bookstores as well, shouldn't we?
Of course, yeah. So I'm doing some independent ones to the world today. So, yeah, no, exactly. But it's just a lovely look. It's like getting back in a warm bath. You don't want to get back in a warm bath. Getting into a hot bath. There's some sort of bath analogy that I need.
Some sort of bath thing.
Like that.
Indeed. Yeah. If anybody's out there and wants to be a writer, what's your advice? Yeah. Apart from don't do it. What's your advice going to be?
Just don't do it. My advice is finish something. Absolutely. Just finish. Doesn't matter. Just write something and finish it. So I know people that are always starting books. I'm going to write a book. And then they'll get, you know, if they're lucky, a third of the way through, and then the better idea will come up and they'll chase after that. And after all, like, you could have written 10 brilliant short stories by now. And it's bad for the soul to this is why writing books is better than telly for me, because you're finished. You've got something to show for it. You've got something to finish that you can put on the shelf and go, look, I wrote that. So just finish. Even if you're going to write 100-word short story, and that's a challenge in itself, write, or 500 words, whatever, just write a little short story and just get through an idea and complete it and then go on to something else. But it's like anything else. I had to sit down and do 500 to 1,000 words a day, every day until it was done. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not like the films. It's not an exciting, glamorous montage. It's a bit of a trudge. But when I was done 500 to 1,000 words a day, I was done. And I got the rest of my day and I can lark about. It's fantastic. So, well, you know.
When you've got a book finished, I mean, there's that great rush when you hit send or whatever you do.
Oh, yeah.
But then you've got, like I said, so it's difficult second album. Then you think, because some people go now on to the next one. It is the hamster on the literary wheel, James.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy with that. I finished this one, did the rewrite, and then I had to get back to writing sort of scripts. My plan is, there's supposed to be 3 Pagans books. This is the idea. So I'm starting the second one after Easter because I'm just doing various other things. But I'm really looking forward to just being able to put everything else aside. Sit down, do my 500 words or to 1,000 words, and then, you know, if it's 10:30, doesn't matter. 10:30 in the morning, it's great. Gonna have a coffee and I'm done for the day. So
yeah.
I am looking forward to getting back in the hamster wheel, really.
Do you write better in the mornings or in the evenings?
Mornings, absolutely. Yeah. And my wife's the same. She's a technical copywriter who's also doing a PhD in medieval history. But we're both writers, and she gets up at 5:30, just cracks on. I get up a little bit later than that, but I like to sort of sit down and anything after lunchtime. I'm struggling to stay awake at the best of times anyway, but it's basically 4 times as hard to produce something that's half as good as I would have written in the morning. So yeah, no, definitely a morning person.
If people want to find you online, say nice things and not get involved in medieval debates about when it actually starts and when the Renaissance kicks in, where should they find you?
I am on Blue Sky. I think if you just look at Blue Sky for James Alistair Henry, I'll be there. I'm on Instagram as something. There's some sort of James Henry related thing there. So, you know, not hard to find.
And you got 20 seconds of free plug for the book, James, so go for it.
Buy the book. It's got a beautiful cover. Some of the words are nice. There's no refunds.
Super duper. And you can also order it via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Pagans. James Alistair Henry, but I call him James Henry. Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.